It truly, truly, truly does my soul so good when the faucet is on perpetually out there to come in here and to sing together, to gather together. It's just like a shot of vitamin D. It restores and reinvigorates my soul. It's so awesome. I'm Christopher. I'm one of the pastors here at River West that has the privilege of opening the Word with you this morning. You're going to need a Bible this morning. We're going to dig deep into the Scriptures today. So if you need a Bible, just raise your hand. The ushers will come around, get a printed Word in your hands this morning. Very, very excited about opening up the passage that we're going to camp on in Mark's Gospel as we continue our series that we've entitled The Way of the Cross. And throughout this series, as we've been making our way, as a guy said, cutting through the frogs. I don't know. It depends where you live. We've been cutting through the fog, and we've been fixing our eyes on Jesus' cross. We've been making our way as people of the cross closer and closer to Good Friday and Easter. We've been learning that Jesus' passion, it's more than just a one-time event that happened in history some long time ago. It's a way of life. That in Jesus' passion, his final moments before he was executed on the cross, we actually discover a pattern for our lives. And so we've been honing in on Jesus' last moments, his last few moments with his disciples, and we've been taking notes for how our way of life can be shaped by Jesus' last week on earth. And with Good Friday and Easter just around the corner, these moments, these precious last moments, every single word that Jesus shares with his disciples, it's just weighted with so much meaning and significance. And so last week, even as we saw Mary break the alabaster jar and anoint Christ with this oil, and Christ said, she's done a beautiful thing. He also reminds his disciples that his time is short. And he tells them, you know, what she's really done is she has anointed me and prepared me for burial. And so the cross is just around the corner at this point in the story. And from this moment on in Jesus' life, all the events for his betrayal, his arrest, his public execution are set in motion. Just as Christ told his disciples time and time again that he'd be handed over to the religious leaders, that he would be flogged, he'd be mocked, he'd be beaten, that he would be killed and crucified. In 3 days, he would rise again. Knowing this, that this is the moment where he is at and he's going to the cross, Luke records something that has always, always struck me. I've been curious about as a follower of Christ for many years, where in Luke's rendition of the Passion story, he tells us that Christ eagerly desired, before he went to the cross, to celebrate Passover with his disciples. That Christ, he eagerly desired, before he was arrested, before he laid down his life on the cross, there's one thing he had to do with his disciples, and it involved sharing a Passover meal with them. And isn't it interesting, that phrase, eagerly desired, that Jesus, he's been thinking about this moment that we'll see in Mark's gospel where he and his disciples, they find an upper room and they commemorate who the Lord is by sharing a meal together. Have you ever eagerly desired something? Has it just overtaken your imagination? It's all you can think about. In our house, my boys have been eagerly desiring spring break for many, many, many weeks. You know, my wife and I, many times we have to kind of like kickstart processes where they clean up their room and they do things. Bags have been packed now for 2 weeks. 2 weeks. My oldest son, Hayden, we're going to go away for a few days and spend some time together. It's just been a busy season for us. And his bag's been packed. And this week, he's been so squirrely. His mind, all he can think about and talk about is what we're going to do next week where we have some time together. We found a place on VRBO where we're gonna do some kayaking off of this river. And he's just jazzed. And he has been so squirrely. He just can't focus on anything else. And he said, "Dad, I just can't help it. There's ants in my pants because spring break is just around the corner." And I love that. My oldest son, he's like loves these like turn of phrases. And I go, "I get it. I get it. You eagerly desire spring break, just like I eagerly desire the sun to return, as the Pacific Northwest is just weeping for the return of Jesus Christ and the sun to return. I've been eagerly desiring a break in the weather." So we're going to get spring break, but perhaps not a break in the weather. So, but this is the emotion that Christ is carrying around in his Passion Week, is he's eagerly desiring a meal, a moment with his disciples where they're going to gather together and he's going to use this opportunity to teach them something central to their lives as disciples. And in many regards, what we're going to see Christ do over this last supper with his disciples, this Passover meal, is he's going to impart to them what will become his last will and testament. It's Jesus' last will and testament. The whole account of Christ's final hours and this final address where he finds an opportunity in an upper room to address his disciples, he's giving them instructions of how to live their lives after he dies. And so with that, grab the word and open with me, if you will, to Mark's gospel, and we're going to pick up right where we left off last week in Mark chapter 14. After Jesus has been anointed by Mary, we are going to pick up in that passage right in verse 12 and continue our Way of the Cross series this morning. "And on the first day of unleavened bread, when they had sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, 'Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?' And he sent two of his disciples and said to him, 'Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. And wherever he enters, say to the master of the house, "The teacher says, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" And he will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. There prepare for us." And the disciples set out and went to the city and found it just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. And when it was evening, he came with the 12. And as they were reclining at the table and eating, Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They began to be sorrowful and say to him one after another, "Is it I?" He said to them, "It is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." And as they were eating, he took bread, and after blessing it, broke it, and gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I will not drink again the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And this is God's word. This morning, what we're going to do with our time together is hone in on four words that Jesus uses in this passage to direct our thinking, our worship, everything. It's going to come down to four words that Jesus used: the word take, bless, break, and give. You may have noticed those four words, the four Greek verbs in the passage that we just read, where Jesus took the bread and he blessed it and he broke it and then he gave it to his disciples. And while we often hear these four words recited when we celebrate communion, as we will later on in the service today, these words actually appear, this group, this pattern of four words, they appear throughout Jesus' life and ministry. Same four Greek verbs appear clustered together in Jesus' life and ministry, like the time when Jesus fed the crowd of 5,000 men and women, children. Mark tells us that he took the five loaves, that he blessed God and gave thanks for it, that he broke it, and then he gave it to his disciples, and a miracle happened. Or how about the time on the Emmaus Road where Jesus shows up incognito to two really, really discouraged disciples who are on their way out of Jerusalem, abandoning all hope that Christ was the one that would restore God's people, that would redeem God's people, are leaving Jerusalem, and Jesus is having a conversation with them. But Luke tells us they didn't recognize it was really Jesus as he was teaching them how the scriptures foretold that Christ would have to die on the cross, that the Messiah would have to suffer and die. As he opened the scriptures, they didn't realize it was Jesus until Luke says he took the bread and blessed it and broke it and then gave it to them. And then Luke tells us that their eyes were opened and they recognized that it was Jesus. Isn't that fascinating? These four words are grouped together, I believe, for a divine purpose. Even the Apostle Paul, when he writes to the church in Corinth, and he says, when you come together and you approach the table and you get drunk, I just need to let you know, it's not the Lord's Supper that you are celebrating. You're missing the mark, Corinthians. You're not celebrating the Lord's Supper. So here's what I want you to do. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took the bread and he blessed God and he broke it and he gave it to the disciples. And when you come together, this is what I want you to do. I want you to take. I want you to bless. I want you to break it and I want you to share. And as you do, you'll proclaim the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ until he returns. Isn't that fascinating? These four words, they appear everywhere in the New Testament. Same four words, take, bless, break, and give. I've never seen or appreciated this four action word pattern until I have been studying Mark's gospel personally this last week. And I believe, as we'll see this morning, these four Greek verbs, take, bless, break, give, they're more than just communion table instructions. Although they're absolutely centered around the bread and the cup and the Eucharist communion, they're more than just communion table instructions. They actually describe a way of life, a pattern of life that we see lived out in Jesus' ministry, where he took and received from God all things, even the difficult things, and he blessed God and was willing to be broken so that others might be blessed. That is, if you think about it, the way of the cross. A way of taking all that God gives, especially the difficult, painful things in life, rejoicing in who the Lord is, being willing to be broken so that others might be blessed as your life is given out. That's the way of the cross. And we see that in Jesus' life. in his final week in the Passion of Christ. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to camp on each of these four words, take, bless, break, and give one by one, and allow the Holy Spirit to teach us how we can live out this way of the cross as followers of Christ. And so let's start with word number one. Word number one is take. Jesus took the bread, Mark tells us in verse 22, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to them and said, take, this is my body. And he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank it. They all partook. You know, unlike every other world religion, Christianity actually starts not by giving or contributing anything, but by coming as a taker, as a receiver. It all starts with receiving, with taking. And that's why I believe in Luke and Paul's retelling of this Last Supper account in the upper room, Jesus says, do this in remembrance of me. Whenever you gather, what I want you to do is I want you to come to the table. I want you to take the bread. I want you to receive it. I want you to take the cup. I want you to receive these elements. And I want you to hold these things in your hands, these things that have been given. And I want you to do all of this in remembrance of what I've done for you. I want you to come and receive. And so the way of the cross, it actually starts with taking and receiving. Not by what we can give or by what we do, but if the starting point is actually what Christ has done for us, and we come with our need to the table. That's what sets Christianity apart from any other religion, is we don't come to give anything. We come to receive what Christ has done, and then life and redemption and grace flows out of our receiving. And so Christ says, whenever you come together, I want you to do this. Take the cup, take the bread, and do this in remembrance of me. Receive and remember. Which is fitting because, as Mark reminds us in this passage, it's the first night of Passover week in Jerusalem. And I love how he tells us that it's Passover with this assignment for the two disciples to go find a jug of water guy. This is one of the stranger things that Christ told his disciples to do. Can you imagine? I mean, so you're going to go into Jerusalem, and here's your assignment. Look for the jug of water guy. Follow him wherever he goes. Once you find a jug of water person, second instruction, follow him into his house. And then tell him, Jesus needs the room that you've prepared so that we can have Passover. I imagine what it felt like, you know, to be those disciples that went on this assignment, those two guys that Jesus sent ahead, and they're just looking everywhere, you know, for a jug of water person, and they finally find him, and they go, there's our guy, and they follow this jug of water guy into his house, and God has sovereignly arranged the whole thing. Jesus has eagerly desired this moment, and God has sovereignly arranged a guy carrying a jug of water, a house that has an empty upper room. They find it all, they go, this is amazing, and then they begin to prepare a Passover meal. Everything's there for them to prepare it, by the way. So it's all this setup for this lesson that Christ is going to teach through this meal, where they're going to come together, they're going to eat the meal. But as you might be aware, the whole purpose of Passover week is remembering. It's a week of remembering, of commemorating God's redemptive love that brought his people out of captivity in Egypt. The whole point of Passover is to commemorate and remember the salvation story of Israel, that God brought them out of Egypt when they were slaves. Everything about Passover helps God's people remember what the Lord has done. And so as they're setting up this room, I wonder if those two disciples, their minds are thinking of the Exodus story. And in the Exodus story, before this great deliverance plan was set in motion where God brought his people out of captivity in Egypt, out from under Pharaoh's bondage and rule, and liberated them, he told his people, here's what I want you to do. I want you to start off by preparing a meal. I want you to cook some unleavened bread. You don't have time to let it rise. I want you to cook this bread in a hurry because I'm going to bring you out tonight of Egypt. I want you to cook this unleavened bread, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to find a lamb without blemish, and I want you to slaughter it and put the blood of that lamb over your doorposts, and then go into your homes and have a meal. Roast the lamb and watch me deliver you out of Egypt. And as God's people did that, the Lord passed over Egypt, and every home that had the blood of the lamb over it was spared. And God poured out judgment on the Egyptians and brought his people out of Egypt. And so that's the meal that Jesus' disciples are preparing, is this commemoration meal. In fact, it's interesting, in Exodus 12:14, as God is enacting this great deliverance plan, he talks about the meal and he says, it's so important. I want you to eat this same Passover meal over and over and over again. It will be a perpetual memorial throughout all generations, a statute forever. You shall keep it as a feast. You'll always commemorate. I want you to always remember, never forget what I've done. You're no longer slaves because of what I've done for you. So I don't want you to live as slaves. Never forget this story. Always remember what I've done and do it through this meal throughout all generations. And this is exactly what Jesus is doing with his disciples. They are celebrating the Exodus story through the Passover meal. And while they're eating, at one point in the meal, Jesus, he stands up, he takes the bread, and after blessing it, he gives it to them and he says, take. This is my body. Now, if you're a Jew reading this story, it's really actually not that surprising that Jesus gets up here and begins to speak and teach, because you're not just supposed to eat the Passover meal. Somebody has to explain it. In fact, if any of you grew up Jewish or have celebrated a Seder meal before, you're probably aware that you have to have a presider, somebody who explains all the different elements from the glasses of wine to the bread of affliction, to the bitter herbs, to the roasted lamb. Every element needs to be explained in this meal. And so ordinarily, a presider would get up and say things like, this is the bread of affliction, which our fathers ate in the wilderness. They suffered with the hope that one day God would redeem and deliver Israel. And instead of doing that, Jesus is getting up and saying, this bread right here, this bread of affliction, is actually my body. Take it. Eat it. Tonight in Jerusalem, it's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and it's the night that the lambs are slain. You know this. But you see this cup? My blood is going to be poured out so that you might be delivered from the bondage of sin and death. And I'm enacting a new covenant, a new exodus through my death for you. Take this bread. Take this cup, because it's all about me. And Christ, he could not have made these claims to be Israel's long-promised Messiah any more emphatically. It's astonishing that Christ is saying everything about the Passover meal points to me. I am the bread. I am the lamb. My blood is what brings the forgiveness, the liberation, the new life. It's all about me. Eat and drink and remember me. You know, it's interesting that communion, coming to the table, is the only thing Christ ever explicitly commands his disciples to do when we gather together over and over and over again. He says, I want you to do this in remembrance of me. Never stop commemorating the gospel story together. I want you to take this, receive it, and re-remember me whenever you gather together. In fact, the Greek word that Christ uses in Luke's account of this Last Supper, when he says, do this in remembrance of me, it's the Greek word anamnesis, which sounds like amnesia, doesn't it? It's where we get the word amnesia from this Greek word anamnesis, which is a disease where we lose our faculty and abilities to remember. And so Christ says, I want you to do all of this. Always be receiving this bread and this cup and re-remembering the gospel story. And honestly, folks, my greatest problem in life as a Christ follower is some days I wake up and I live like a man who's forgotten the gospel story. I live like a guy who has gospel amnesia for a period of time. Sometimes I forget. Perhaps on a subconscious level, my memory lapses and I forget that I'm loved, that I'm accepted, that I'm cleansed, that I'm being made new by Jesus, that his blood washes over all of my sins, that he's with me, that he is God with me, no matter what I'm facing. And I forget these truths. And when I do, I buy into the same old lies that enslave me, that derail me, that get me back in the fog. I forget. I forget the gospel story. I don't know about you, but many times, I mean, my memory is so faulty when it comes to remembering God's faithfulness. I can remember my Netflix account password, but I forget the most essential things. And perhaps you're like me. You can remember some things, but essential things about who Christ is and who you are because of what he's done, we have a terrible memory problem. We live like people that have gospel amnesia so often. But River West, this is why we come back to the communion table, to remember, to take the bread, to take the cup, and re-remember the gospel story and how much Christ loves us and what he's done for us. And we don't often think of communion like this, as a discipleship tool. But what communion does, I'm learning, is it trains us. It trains us. It trains us to remember the goodness of Jesus in our lives, in our community, in our church, in our world. It trains our hearts, our minds, our hands, our taste buds to taste and see that the Lord is good. And so Christ says, here's what I want you to do. Whenever you come together, I want you to take the bread, take the cup. Remember who I am and what I've done for you, but don't stop there. As you do that, rejoice, bless. Take it, and then bless God for it. Word number two is bless. following the pattern of Jesus, Jesus took the bread and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to his disciples and said, "Take, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. You know, in Scripture, the bread and the cup of communion are called the Eucharist. We get the term Eucharist from a Greek word, eukareo, which literally means to give thanks. So this is actually, it's a Thanksgiving meal. The Eucharist, the heart of the Eucharist is actually about rejoicing and giving thanks. Jesus took the bread and he blessed the Lord, which is a form of thanksgiving. He took the cup, and Mark tells us, and all the other gospel writers account for the same thing. He gave thanks for it. You know, by way of confession, the rain has made it really difficult for me lately to rejoice. I have been having a hard time rejoicing and giving thanks. I've been trying to work this discipline into my life more regularly, and the rain has been coming against me. I've been having a hard time. I've been having a hard time with this rejoicing thing. Is anyone with me? It's a little too much. A little bit too much? Okay, like three or four of you. Everyone else is just like happy. Okay, but this is like what the Lord is sanctifying in my life. It's been hard. My backyard right now is a wet, muddy mess. I've been joking and telling my wife, you know, babe, we should really actually just host a neighborhood mud bogging competition or like a tractor pull, because that's the only thing that's going on in my backyard right now. And I have large dogs and active children. And so this has been my reality lately. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. It is the Valley of the Sun. You transplants from other places, you haven't come to a place that's actually named by the sun. I came out of Sunland into Valley of the Shadow of Death. Okay? As with a sanguine personality and a disposition to get moody and melancholy. And so Jesus is working on me to rejoice, but I've had to actually stop looking at the 14-day weather forecast from hell. I can't do it. I can't do it. You add into that, you know, just the stuff that life throws at you with like broken toilets and income taxes and muddy dogs and March Madness, like brackets that fell apart. And I just get cranky. I get cranky. And I know I'm not alone. I'm not alone. Because it's almost a badge of honor here living in Oregon to bemoan the weather this time of year. I go up to a person, I'm like, hey, how are you doing? It's like, man, this is great. This is awesome right here. I have a wet shoe, you know? Like, that's what's been going on in our life. So let me share with you here. Okay. Every now and then, I lose my bearings. What gets me into the fog is actually grumbling and complaining. What gets me to take my eyes off of Jesus and derails me more than anything is I stop rejoicing, and here's what I'm learning. When I stop rejoicing regularly, I stop remembering. I stop remembering. That whole gospel amnesia thing, it sets in when I actually stop giving thanks regularly. And so rejoicing is actually what helps us to remember the goodness and graciousness of Jesus in our everyday life. And I want to share with you a story that snapped me out of my funk this week. I was getting funky, and I had a bad attitude. In Mark chapter 6, the story where Jesus is feeding the 5,000, I never made the connection that in this story, Jesus' disciples are really cranky and they're not in a rejoicing mood whatsoever. So here's the backstory. And then in Mark 6, we're going to read this. They're in a bad mood. And Mark tells us, so he's going to show us, they're angsty, they're passive aggressive, they're in a bad mood. But they had hoped to get away with Jesus on a little R&R vacation with Jesus. Jesus had invited his disciples to get away with them. It had been so busy that Mark's going to tell us that it didn't even have time to eat. And so maybe low blood sugar was involved, but they're testy, they're cranky. And Jesus is going to teach them a powerful lesson about giving thanks in Mark chapter 6 through the feeding of the 5,000. So follow with me. And starting in verse 34 in Mark 6, Mark tells us when he went ashore, that is Jesus, he saw a great crowd. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many, many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. I love the honesty of the gospel accounts at times. When I read this story, the reason it snapped me out of my funk is because I find myself in the disciples in this story. Their well-laid plans are blown up. They had hoped to actually get alone with Jesus. The crowd of people found out where Jesus was, and they're tired, they're hungry, they're running on empty, and then they go up to Jesus, and with great passive aggression, they tell him, "You know, Jesus, it's getting late. I don't know if you've seen the time. I mean, there's a great crowd of people here. This is a desolate place. You're right about that. But the only problem is there's a great crowd of people here, Jesus, and you probably ought to send these folks away. You know, that would be the compassionate thing to do so that they can go back home and eat, and we can carry on, you know, with our plan." And Jesus, I love this, he turns to his disciples and he tells them something which must have sounded like utter nonsense. He looks them dead serious, squares off with them and says, "Give them something to eat. You guys, just give them something to eat." I love this, that Jesus, he just says, "You know, guys, this whole event right here, here's how we're going to fix the problem. You guys just give them something to eat." And I love this, their response. They say, "You know, Jesus, okay, where in the world are we going to get 200 denarii, 200 days' wages worth of food? We got Matthew, the tax collector, over there. He's added it up, Jesus. It's going to take about 200 denarii, you know, worth of food. Where are we going to get that? We'd be happy, you know, to feed everyone. They're cranky with Jesus here. But Jesus tells them something that's so instructive. He says, "Well, why don't you find out how many loaves you do have? What do you have? Go and see." And so he tells them, no. Like, I want you to go find out what you do have, not what you don't have. Go find out what you do have and come back and tell me. And like the disciples so often, I think we get fixated on what we don't have in life. Instead of rejoicing and giving thanks for what we have, we lament the fact that there's dirty dishes undone in the sink, while we forget to give thanks for the meal that we have just enjoyed, while many in our world today go hungry. We focus on the finances that we need, or the things that we're lacking monetarily, instead of thanking God what he's already graciously provided for us. We focus on the woes of walking a 100-pound Labrador out in the rain every day, or he goes insane. But we fail to hypothetically thank God for the pet who's excited to see us every day, even when we're in a bad mood. You see, folks, we focus on the five loaves and the two fish, and we forget the fact that we're in company with Jesus, Lord of the universe, that can take what feels insignificant in our lives and miraculously multiply it. We forget the God who is with us, the God who has graciously provided and prepared another day of grace for us, and we stop rejoicing. But as we rejoice, it's what clears the fog and helps us remember how good and gracious is. And here's where communion helps us again. Because as we take the bread and the cup, we're reminded that our circumstances don't dictate our joy. Jesus does. Jesus does. The reason that we can rejoice is because we're in company with a Savior that can take our lives when we feel we do not have enough and the stakes are high and we don't have it in us to respond and make it through another season. We're in company with Jesus, whose specialty is taking insignificant things and making it enough. And that's exactly what happens in Mark chapter 6. In verse 41, I love how this story progresses. Jesus tells him, I want you to go and see what do you have. And taking the five loaves and the two fish they had, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the two fish among them all, and they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish, and those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men, plus women and children. It's amazing. I love that a story began with blown up plans and bad attitudes all around, ends with a crowd of full bellies and baskets of leftovers. And Mark tells us there were 12 baskets, by the way. How many disciples did Jesus have? 12. I wonder if Christ was trying to teach them a lesson with those baskets of leftovers. I want you to go pick up the bread and the fish leftover. There's more than enough. Simon, Matthew, Andrew, disciple of Jesus, here's a basket for you. I want you to go pick up the leftovers. I love this because what I think Christ is trying to drive home to him is when we fixate on what we don't have instead of bringing what we do have to Jesus and trusting him with it, that's when we fail to remember the gospel. We fail to live out the way of the cross, because this whole point, I believe, of the bread and fish miracle is it all began with giving thanks with what they had. Before the miracle happened, Christ took what felt insignificant and gave thanks for it, and that paved the way for full bellies and a crowd that was satisfied. And what would happen in your life, friends, if you took your eyes off what you don't have and you began to live out this pattern? Wake up, and this is what I've been learning to do this week. First take, saying, Lord, thank you. Thank you for the gift of another day. Lord, thank you. Begin in your prayers by receiving from Jesus, thanking him for the gifts that he's already prepared that you can see. Go into your life and start seeing the grace in disguise. And thank him for what you have. And what will happen, perhaps your circumstances won't change, but something will happen in you where you'll be satisfied, you'll be filled, and your whole perspective on life will change. It'll revolutionize the way that you live, that you love others, that you're attentive to God's work in your life. We underestimate the power of giving thanks and rejoicing. We underestimate that this is the dynamite of the Christian life. is developing this discipline of waking up every day, take and receive every day as another gift, and thank the Lord. Rejoice with Jesus, who took the bread, who took the cup, and gave thanks. But that's not enough. We take, we bless, but then we must break. We must follow Jesus and be willing to break. Because unless the bread is broken, it can't be shared. So we take, we bless, and we break. Jesus, he took the bread. He gave thanks. And then he broke it. Knowing on the same night that Passover lambs all over in Jerusalem were slaughtered, Christ knew that his slaughter, his execution was imminent. And so he gave thanks for this bread, knowing that this bread of affliction was going to be his affliction, was going to be his execution on a cross. And so he said, this is my body. This is my body. This is what's going to happen to my body, is it's going to be broken. Took the cup knowing that his blood was going to be spilled, and he gave thanks anyway. You know, folks, we tend to view brokenness, I think many times, even as followers of Christ, as a purely negative thing, as an unwelcome intruder that robs us of the things that God is developing in our lives. But let me tell you something. Let me tell you something that I feel like the Lord has been patiently teaching me. The way of the cross is a way of inviting Jesus into our brokenness with belief that he can transform broken things in our lives, areas of pain, into channels of blessing in other people's lives. The way of the cross is a way of brokenness, a way of admitting that life may break us, but that God does his greatest blessings through broken spaces, through wounds. You know, a couple months ago, I got a call, and I learned that our church was hosting a dessert night for an amazing woman, Johnny Erickson Tata. It was a last-minute thing. Apparently, Johnny was coming into town, and she was speaking at a mission connection that I was participating in. And they were looking for a church to host this dessert night. And Adam Nowak, many of you know Adam Nowak, he was familiar with the ministry of Johnny and Friends, and he helped arrange this dessert night at the church. And so Adam had invited me to come and to come hear Johnny's story. And so I was on my way to go have a meal with my family, and I told my wife, hey, babe, I'm going to have a quick dinner with you guys, and then I'm going back to the church, and there's this woman, Johnny Erickson Tata, is going to be there. And my wife freaked out. She's like, Johnny's going to be there? And what you guys need to know, I didn't grow up in the church. My wife, one of her heroes of the faith was Johnny Erickson Tata, had read Johnny's story, read the story of how the Lord had worked through her life. At the age of 17, she had a diving accident. Where she crushed her vertebrae and she was paralyzed from the neck down and has lived her life ever since that day, 17 years old, as a quadriplegic. And so Johnny was hosting a dessert night at the church, but I didn't know who Johnny was. I was familiar that she was an amazing woman that had actually gone around the world and helped people that had been impacted by disability, bringing the gift of mobility to them. I was familiar with those things, but I really didn't know Johnny's story. So I showed up here at the church. The room was being set up, and there was a woman who was going around, and she was kind of giving off the vibe that she's just in charge. You know, like, you ever walked into a room, and you can clearly tell, like, this person is the authority. Like, this person, you know, is in charge, and was asking about, you know, getting some projection and things to pass out that evening. I was like, wow, this must be Johnny. I went up to this woman, and she had some walkers. And I went up to her, and I said, you must be Johnny. And she started laughing at me. big time. And she said, oh, child, I'm not Johnny. Johnny is in a wheelchair, and she's going to show up here in a little while. But I'm with Johnny and friends. And she started laughing at me, and I felt so embarrassed. My face was flushed. I didn't know who Johnny was. I'd never heard Johnny's story. And she was very, very, very gracious, and she began to share with me, this is Johnny's story. She was paralyzed, and she's going to be here. And the Lord has brought more than 100,000 wheelchairs to people through her ministry. She's gone to 43 countries. Hundreds of thousands of people have heard about the hope of Jesus through her story. I got to meet Johnny. I didn't let her know that I had no idea who she was. She was very gracious to me. I was very moved by her story. She's an amazing woman. And at one point towards the end of the evening, she said something I'll never forget. She said this. She said, sometimes God permits what he hates in order to accomplish what he loves. She said, this is the lesson that God has taught me in my life, is that sometimes the Lord permits things he hates in order to accomplish the things that he loves. And that moved my heart so much, because through her life, through her brokenness, through her tragedy, others, countless others, have been blessed, given the gift of mobility. Our church now is partnering with Johnny and Friends and seeking ways that our church community can be a place to actually bless, encourage, be an instrument of grace in the lives of families impacted by disability. Unbelievable what Jesus does when we come to him with our brokenness. Sometimes God permits the things he hates in order to accomplish the things that he loves. And folks, there's no greater proof of this than the cross. In his death, Jesus' body was broken to pieces on the cross. And in that breaking, Jesus binds up our brokenness and turns us into people that bind up the brokenness of others in his name. Christ was wounded. He was abused so that we might be healed. He was rejected and mocked and betrayed by his closest friends, so that we might be accepted forever into God's family. He was killed so that you and I might have eternal life in his name. River West, this is the word of the gospel that we cling to, that we trust. But it's also the way that the gospel works in and through the church. When I look at what the Lord is doing in our church community, the greatest streams of ministry are happening, are flowing out of our church through broken people that have allowed Christ to work through their wounds. Through their wounds. Friends, Jesus always accomplishes his greatest miracles through wounds. Bring your brokenness to him, your broken up life, and just put it in Jesus' hands and watch what he does through that. I wish I would have known this lesson many, many years ago, that we come to Christ with our brokenness, and that's what's transformed and redeemed and turned into a blessing in others' lives.